From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Media Project is an opportunity for us to give you a half hour of analysis and commentary and perhaps even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, and I'm here with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Well, good morning, you're Rexford.
Good afternoon and good evening and all of the above. Yes, let's just be clear what time of day we're in.
Yeah, wherever you are, that's what it is.
Wherever you may be in the multiple time zones of the Northeast Public Radio galaxy. Over there is Ira Fussfeld, the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Hello, Rex and everyone.
How do, sir? And then here is Kaylin Brown, the head of the journalism program at the College of St. Rose. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, good. Classes are over for the season.
Classes are over for some of us. Some of us are teaching summer classes, but not I.
Well, then, it's very good of you to show up and put in some time here. How about that? All right. We want to start by talking about an interesting report on how the public might misunderstand things that we journalists do. There's a new large-scale survey of public attitudes toward journalism and also of journalists' views of the public. And here's something kind of interesting. There are a whole lot of terms that this survey ran around and said, what does this mean? And it asked the public, what do you think? And, you know, some of it was not surprising. 9 out of 10 in the public know what breaking news means. But here are some terms that might confuse people. What is native advertising? Okay, well, there's silence in this studio.
I think that even some of us would be hard-pressed to actually describe it. I sort of refer to it as advertorial, but it's advertising that appears, particularly in digital, that looks like it's news.
I think it is one of the most pernicious trends. Advertisers love it because it's very effective, because you're using the techniques of journalism to sell stuff, but it confuses the public. It is intended to confuse the public, to confuse that line between journalism that is independent and what people pay to have present on a site.
Rex, if somebody were to help me with my confusion here, if somebody wanted to buy a space for native advertising from you, would we see it in the Times Union?
We don't usually use the term in print, but it would be like having a special section that isn't labeled as being advertising.
They don't have to put advertising in little teensy, tiny letters at the top.
We do that.
But the print doesn't have to do anything because we're not regulated. We can do whatever we want.
No. But, you know, Rex is always pontificating about his ethical stuff.
Well, a lot of times an advertiser will try to take out an ad that looks like a news story to appear in the pages of the paper. And I know what our paper used to insist was that it could only be run if it was in a typeface different than the news typeface.
So it might be interesting to know from you guys, and Kaylin too, even though she's not publishing a paper or hasn't done that, is whether or not with the downward spiral of print journalism, in other words, it's tougher to make a buck, whether or not native advertising, as you've described it, is on the upswing.
Yes, that is an interesting phenomenon. I think it's true. There is much more of an interest in concealing the fact that advertising is bought and paid for. And I think there's greater confusion on the part of the public. Same thing goes for the term fake news, you know. That's what this survey found.
Sure.
You know, while 71% of the people said, yes, made up stories from news outlets that don't exist is fake news, and that's how the term originated. But substantial numbers also said that fake news means journalists from real news organizations making things up, 62%, and stories that are unfair or sloppy, 43% fake news. That's the way that President Trump uses the term fake news.
Well, he uses it as made up, right?
Well, yeah, actually, he uses it for legitimate stories that he doesn't like. That's how he actually uses it.
And also alleges that there are no sources when newspapers cite, you know, a story and say, according to sources, and he will say the sources were made up.
Even when the sources are people who the White House has trotted out intentionally to talk to the press. Yes.
And even when the source is him.
Yeah, right, right.
Well, in the rare event that an actual journalist makes up content, I'm thinking about Jason Blair from the New York Times back years ago, there's a disproportionate attention paid by the journalism field to those who fall by the wayside or do manufacture false information and make things up. Because of that disproportionate attention paid, I think that results in the public questioning what's real and what's fake.
See, well, you're right, of course, but why do you use the word disproportionate so casually? In other words, disproportionate is one of the reasons we have to be very clear to our people and everybody else why, you know, it's a firing offense to make something up.
That's a good point. I mean, I think what Kaylin's trying to say, not to be her lawyer here, but she was saying is that we we're so aggressive about pointing out the flaws when journalists are violating the tenets of the Code of Ethics that it makes people think that it's more widespread than it is. The very fact that we still know the name of Jason Blair 20 years after his offense is indication of how big a deal it is when somebody makes things up.
Or Jana Cook at the Washington Post when she made up a story about a heroin addict and they had to return the Pulitzer Prize and it was a chapter in Ben Bradley's book. I mean, all of, you know, that stuff.
I think that was like 40 years ago or something. So it does, yeah. We
40
still,
years ago.
We
oh, I remember. Was I alive then?
Time does pass faster.
Well, and it's, you know, because the print and broadcast media police themselves and then broadcast and print what they've discovered in their policing, the public is much more aware of the errors that we make of commission and omission. Whereas other industries, other businesses, they may have the same internal structures to weed out mistakes, but they don't put a sign on their front door that says, "We made a mistake here last week, and here's how we fixed it." There's a sense that only the media makes mistakes. But it's just that we tell everybody when we make a mistake because we want to own up to it.
In all due reverence, I agree with you. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that people get indicted all the time. Mm-hmm. Businesses get into terrible trouble. But the media beats its breasts and talks about how good we are all the time, and we're not always that good. And people do make up stories every once in a while. And
I'm not denying that.
At 12 o'clock at night and saying, I wonder if somebody could have said this.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, and the analogy is not perfect, if the media makes a mistake, they will own up to it in print and people will learn about it and hopefully believe that we're serious in trying to fix it. If Joe the barber gives a series of bad haircuts, he doesn't put a sign on his window saying, "I apologize, I gave a series of bad haircuts and I fired the barber who did it." Those mistakes are sort of handled quietly.
Well, you know, I don't
like
know.
That. I think Ira's really doing well there, Ellen.
Well, of course, let's see. One, two, three versus me. But the fact is that people who are looking at bad news from a newspaper that they did something wrong, often that newspaper has been caught rather than having discovered it themselves.
Well, if you mean by caught that there's a mistake in the paper.
Somebody, a third party, found out.
Well, that's fine. You know, I think most newspapers now invite people to let us know if we've made a mistake.
And you get it very quickly. I was, two nights ago, I spent a lot of time on the phone at 9:30 p.m. over a tiny issue on page C2 of the print edition. We had published a story digitally about a car accident west of the Capital Region. Mm-hmm. And I got a phone call from a known and trusted source, let's say, who is a friend of a victim, and saying, you know, you got something wrong there. You really need to take a look at that and correct it. And here I am. So I'm on the phone at 9:30 at night with the executive producer and with the print desk, because we're dealing with both the digital and the print edition. One of the great advantages of the digital world now is that you can correct on the spot and you can fix your errors when you've had a mistake. The mistake actually was not on the part of the journalist. The mistake was on the part of the law enforcement sources who gave bad information to the reporter. But it's a great thing when you can actually fix something, a factual error, however minor, and get it right.
But going back to that survey you were referring to, if I heard you correctly, did you say 62% of the respondents believed in and are aware of what they call fake news?
Yes.
Yeah, that's terribly troubling, and it seems to indicate that the Trump impact is being felt. Even today as we speak, he again is talking about the media being the enemy of the people or the biggest enemy. This is sopping in. It's soaking in. There are people willing to believe it, and it's going to take a long time, if ever, for them to rid themselves of that. And I just think the harm he has done to us and in general is incalculable.
You know, the difficulty is that what we usually think of as the solution to this is to simply do our job more aggressively, to be more aggressive about truth-telling, to be better about fact-checking even. Here's a study by a Stanford PhD student, not yet published, that analyzes how fact-checking affects the rhetoric of presidential candidates in the last two elections. And the student, Chloe Lim is her name, found that when a fact-checking organization rated a politician's claim as false, that politician was only about 10% less likely to repeat the claim. So that's not a great impact of fact-checking.
And we know that because the Washington Post, Rex, of course, very famously now, last time we looked, had Trump up over 2,000 lies.
4,000. Yeah. 4,000 lies. Yeah, 4,000 lies since he took office.
That's extraordinary. It certainly hasn't stopped him.
No, six times a day on average, he actually misstates the facts. And sometimes, you know, when we use the word lies, it suggests that he intends to do so.
Indeed, that's exactly what it means.
Maybe that he just doesn't know. You know, sometimes he's really out
of
touch.
Well, that renews the argument we had long before Trump came onto the political scene when we talked on this program about our reticence to use the word lying, to say somebody lied, because as Rex points out, you never can be actually sure that the person is knowingly lying or if he is simply misinformed and is regurgitating something he's heard elsewhere. But what we've seen in the Trump era is the increasing use of the word lying, because
I use it all the time and I'm proud of it.
Me too. Well, I called him a pathological liar on these microphones, I think, before he was elected. But most people have come around to that now.
Well,
yeah, not his supporters.
Yeah. No, you know, but what Ira just said deserves just one more little line, and that is a pathological liar is somebody who doesn't know that they're lying.
Ah, well, that's
you
interesting.
You see, I believe that Trump knows full well that he's lying.
That would be an intentional liar. I don't know what that would be.
This PhD student's study, though, so I thought it was positive that fact-checking was at least causing the politicians to reel back some of the lies that they are perpetuating. But what about not lying? How do you fix that?
How do you fix that?
How do you fix that?
Well, if you take somebody like Senator Warren in Massachusetts, who at one point talked about her Indian ancestry, got called up short on that, and then that raises for all of us who listen or participate in the Media Project, what should you do when you're wrong?
Caught with that?
Yeah.
Now, she explains that by saying, well, all of her life she'd been told that she had Native American ancestors from Oklahoma, right? And believed that to be true, and so she used it. And here's the thing. You should always think, as you're going forward in life, what would happen if you ran for president and your stuff was actually checked, or if you were given the full scrutiny of the American press? Think of what happened to Brian Williams of NBC News when this anecdote that he had told many times about being in a war zone, a combat situation, got fully vetted and it was found out to be untrue.
Same thing with Hillary.
He was not in the helicopter.
Blew up his job.
Yeah, and they show that when Clinton was lying, dropping false claims, is how the Poynter Institute reports it, that she had a 14.5% probability of changing her rhetoric after the fact, and Trump had a 9.2% probability of changing his rhetoric after the facts were checked. So they all lie. I mean, I don't know. Some people everyone in the world lies.
The question then is, who are their audiences? I mean, if it's the intelligentsia, they might be less ready to accept a lie than somebody who just is waving the flag.
But there's a distinction. You know, there's always been this sense, oh, politicians, they're all a bunch of liars, can't trust them. There's a distinction between the kind of lie the first George Bush committed when he said, read my lips, no new taxes.
Right.
And that was a political promise that was broken. That was not a lie. although it, I guess people could suggest it was a lie, that's different from what Trump does.
Yes,
Trump,
yes, that's
Trump
right.
flat out makes stuff up.
He's a purposeful lie.
Yeah.
And
right.
even in the case that you were citing of Hillary Clinton, one of the examples was when she said, well, the Obama administration created 15 million new private sector jobs. That apparently was an exaggeration. So she stopped saying that after being fact-checked. You know, there are now these various fact-checking organizations. So that is different from Donald Trump. Hardly know where to begin.
There's so many of them.
There was one just this past week where he was responding to the point about returning the remains of those killed in Korea. And he said during the campaign, the parents of the victims were asking to do something about it. And somebody calculated 2 or 3 years ago, the youngest that those parents could have been was 101. And more likely, they were being 110 to 120. In other words, there were no parents. Mm-hmm. But this is his spurting stuff out.
Well, he's still living about 50 years ago, so he thinks that at that time there were parents alive.
Well, but esteemed panel, the one thing I would love to have you guys, who are often apologists for the press, answer is, what do you think a politician caught in a lie should do? Should they immediately apologize and get it off of the table, or should they do something else that would help them to alleviate a bad situation? The reason I raised Senator Warren was because she did mitigate it, Rex, you're right, she heard from her relatives that they had this connection, but she didn't do it early enough, and I think that that's when you get caught.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good staff and good PR people and good crisis communication operators for the politicians would immediately get them to intervene some way. I'm not certain that apologies are enough anymore, because an apology gets trotted out for every misstep now, whether it's a politician, a corporate executive, you know, someone in the Me Too movement. They keep trotting out apologies. To what end?
In fact, our Harry Shearer on our Sunday show, syndicated show, often has what he calls the apologies of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're leftists. You're exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the solution is tell the truth.
And if you're not pathological.
With respect to the media, you know, when the public doesn't necessarily feel that we are being accurate as opposed to lying, I think there's just a concern about accuracy. And it's interestingly divided by age. Most American adults age 18 to 29 think that the news is fairly inaccurate. Most above age 30 feel that the news they're reading is fairly accurate. That's troubling, isn't it? What do you know? So part of the answer is that we need to do a better job of being transparent, explaining our work. I don't know how many people will pay attention to it, because we know that attention spans are limited and that what people consume in the news tends to be bite-sized chunks, right, in little videos.
Well, as long as partisan media continues to come up with different sets of facts, and there is no one set of facts that everyone can agree upon, that spells bad news for us in the media, because many people will disbelieve us, and it spells bad news for the country, because we can't agree on, you know, tomorrow being Saturday or whatever day of the week it is.
Or what the Trump people call alternative facts.
Yeah.
But that demographic of 18 to 29-year-olds who this study is talking about, what percentage of that demographic actually regularly reads the news? I mean, that's problematic. How many 18-year-olds do you know who are reading the news?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Here's a very troubling bit. And again, all of this comes from the Media Insight Project, which is a collaboration between the Associated Press, the NORC Center for Public Affairs, and the American Press Institute. So you look at this survey that's just been released, and here's a troubling bit. 93% of journalists say that our role is to act as a watchdog to powerful people. Only a little more than half of the general public say that the role of the media should be to act as a watchdog. Mm. What do you think about that? I mean, isn't that a bit troubling? I consider that to be a fundamental part of our task. It sounds like people are saying, no, just report what people say.
So,
don't be a watchdog.
So I think what's really being said here is, by the public who fails your test, is to say, Rex, who do you think you are? In other words, you're arrogant. I can't use the B word, I suppose, here. But you're arrogant people who presume that you have been put in place to deal with other people's transgressions, and we don't believe that.
But that's a cornerstone of our democracy. That's the tradition of this country. I know you've argued against that. You know, when one of us might say something like, "We're there representing the public,"
and I always say, "Who elected you?"
Exactly. And in fact, Chris Cuomo, in an interview with the Republican primary winner in Virginia, used the point when the guy was being very combative against him and saying, "No, we're here to represent you." I mean, because he was blaming CNN. It was on and on and on. But that is still a cornerstone of the reason for our being. I think there's an interesting...
No. The cornerstone for the reason of your being is to make money.
No, that's not. A cheap shot.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a cheap shot. That may be why some people invest in news organizations, but journalists are not here to make money. We're here to... because we believe in the mission of the news organization.
And fortunately,
this mission is supported by dollars that advertisers contribute and that people pay for when they buy the news organization.
And generally speaking, you can make money if you perform good journalism. If the public trusts you and believes in what you say, they'll buy your product or watch your TV program. So yes, you can make money, but you have to do it the right way.
Well, that's so simplistic, it seems to me.
Basic.
Well, you may say basic, but then there is the New York POST.
Which is an exception.
I think a lot of individuals are unfamiliar with how government is supposed to work. So I think the general public mostly doesn't deal with the government. Mostly they're doing whatever they do. They go to work. There's a percentage who do work for the government. But my experience from the classroom, but also when I was a young reporter, I was unfamiliar with planning boards and zoning boards and what they did and how they worked and Board of Educations. And if you're unfamiliar with those components of government, it would not make sense to you how journalism acts as a watchdog, because you might not understand what decisions are being made on your behalf.
Well, there's a great survey that I'm sure Rex has in front of him. I was happy to see it, although it cringing when I was seeing it, that in communities where there are either no newspapers or less newspaper coverage than there used to be, and thus government coverage has diminished, if not disappeared, the cost of government in those communities has increased because there's nobody watchdogging them.
That watchdog role, exactly. This new study from Notre Dame University looks at the Rocky Mountain News in Denver, the Cincinnati Post. Now, in both places, there are other newspapers, but even when the competing newspapers have closed, among the things that happened, local government's cost of borrowing money, therefore the risk has increased once the paper is gone. And so the public finances actually suffer when the watchdog of the press is not there.
Which raises questions about what's the responsibility of a citizen, our audience. The responsibility is to know what's going on with your government, to vote, to pay attention to what the news is telling you about your government, and then to make informed decisions. Without that coverage, this is going to continue to escalate because government's not going to have anyone looking over them. Helen Thomas wrote a great book on the story of watchdog journalism, what it meant to be a watchdog at the White House.
Well, you talked about it last week, about Rex saying you no longer cover a lot of communities or boards that you used to cover. You referred to a board meetings that you used to cover. If there are no reporters now at the town board level, at the village board, in the library, school board districts, they can do largely things that they might not have been doing before if there were reporters there watching them.
The Los Angeles Times won a Pulitzer Prize 3 years ago for its reporting on the community, I think, called Bell.
Yes.
Where they found that the town supervisor had been paying himself $700,000 a year or something. There were huge, outrageous expenses. And one of my friends actually shared the Pulitzer for that story, for uncovering this corruption. But here's the thing. If the Los Angeles Times had been covering the town of Bell all along, they would have been aware of this going on at the time. Mm-hmm. It would not have happened. The watchdog role that had been abandoned by the loss of that journalism day to day is what led to the corruption. Well, which ultimately won my friend a Pulitzer Prize. I guess it was good in that effect.
But interestingly, and in a strange twist of irony, Craig Newmark, who founded Craigslist, has donated $20 million to the CUNY Journalism School to try to right the ship and get more journalists trained to do what they're supposed to be doing.
You mean right. The guy who started Craigslist and started the downward fall of newspapers by stealing our classified advertising?
Yeah, but he's a wise and smart businessman, and newspapers were not paying attention at that time.
Stealing your advertising?
Yeah, if more people knew his name, he'd have his picture in every newspaper in the country with a big X in front of it.
Well,
all
I know is that public radio is selling a lot of underwriting, and we're not stealing anybody's anything.
You can trace the decline of classified advertising in newspapers to the origin of Craigslist.
Well, we'll Good come back to that and some other topics. Thanks. Alan wants us all to die. It'll be okay. We'll be fine.
I don't. The arrogance gets me.
Oh, well, we never want to have arrogance on these airwaves.
Station.
That's all. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, Caleb Brown, and Rex Smith, thank you for joining us on the Media Project.
Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the globe. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. Funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.